Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 267, recorded May 15th, 2014. Samsung's affordable 4K 60Hz monitor is here.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by iFixit. You can fix it, and iFixit makes it easy. With free step-by-step repair guides, high-quality replacement parts, and all the tools you'll need. For $10 off your purchase of $50 or more, go to iFixit.com/twit and enter the code TWITCH at checkout.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twit's weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most exciting, and most engaging news in, well, PC hardware, a little bit of the tablet lifestyle, some mobile, and occasionally even the smartphone action, but never antique cell phones. I promise you that. Joining me as always, Mr. Ryan Shrout, with a lovely new background at the PC Per Broadcast Center.
That's right. Yeah, that's what we've renamed it, the PC Perspective Broadcast Center. Trying to step up our game a little bit here. We're going to do some more interesting video stuff. I am curious about the idea of antique phones, though. Are we talking like rotary or...
Have you ever seen the Porto rotary from SparkFun?
No. This is, but I'm guessing by the name, this is something that will let you dial your cell phone like a rotary phone.
I'll tell you what. You should talk about the latest and most affordable 4K monitor actually worth buying because it runs higher than 30 hertz for your desktop. I will look up the Porto rotary phone and drop a link into the rundown, and we will move the podcast along in a glorious and functioning manner.
The monitor he's referring to, of course, is the Samsung U28D590D. In that model number are some bits of information. The D tells you the style that it is, like the form factor. And the U28 is at it's a 28-inch 4K panel. This is 3840 by 2160. It is basically a standard 28-inch display at a super high resolution. It has some unique features to it, right? So this 4K monitor is... I think the first, if not the first we have seen that uses a single scaler, a single stream input. That means that you use a DisplayPort connection from the computer to the monitor, as you would expect, and it just shows up as a 3840 by 2160 monitor for all video cards that support DisplayPort 1.2. You don't have any of the complications of a multi-stream transport display, which is what we saw with the first 4K panels. That were running 3840 by 2160 at 60 hertz, but they had two independent streams of 1920 by 2160 each. And then the driver had to be smart enough to merge those two either through using iFinity or, you know, the driver just kind of implementing it automatically from recognizing the drive. Now, this panel is also 60 hertz, but it's doing it through a single stream. And that's really it's unique for now. There will be plenty of other monitors that come out, I think, this summer. That support single stream transport on 4K. What is also interesting about this monitor is its price. It is, it's a little bit higher than that now, I think. This is one of those things that changes all the time. Last night when we did our other show, we were surprised to find it for sale for $599 direct from Amazon.
You should have called me because I was up, I promise you.
I wrote the article, it was going for $693. Right. I bought the monitor, it was going for $744. And as of this recording, it's like $680 or so.
We should probably take a step back here, right? Because when the first Seiki sort of, you know, the first under $8,000 4K television came out, it was the Seiki, it was 4K, it was running at 30 hertz. Fine for video, fine for television. Pushing it for desktop usage if your eyes were either fine with it or your eyes were going to leap out of your face. You've been using the Asus PDQ321. I've been using that here. Amazing monitor. Unbelievably, it's just gorgeous. right? It's running at 60 hertz. The, you know, the multi-stream technology on DisplayPort works until it doesn't, which is usually every time you do a Windows update or a driver update, then you sort of manually reconfigure it inside of the monitor. You get it up running again. That's a $3,000 monitor. And suddenly we go from $3,000 to $700.
Yeah. Now there are, there are some cuts that are made, right? So PQ321 is an IGZO panel, IGZO. I forget what it stands for right at this moment, but it's very similar to what an IPS display looks like in terms of image quality, viewing angles, color shifting. The Samsung panel is a TN monitor, which will immediately scare a lot of people away, but it is better than your average TN display. One of the things we saw when we first saw these monitors from Asus and Dell and Lenovo and Samsung at CES was we were surprised at how good the viewing angles were for a TN monitor. Still not as good as IPS or PLS or IGZO. You still definitely see some color shift if you move around left or right or up or down. I would say the up and down color shifting was a little bit more obvious than the left and right. And if you were sitting very close to the monitor, you would see slight brightness differences in the corners. But if you sat back a little bit, I had no issues using this monitor for, you know, gaming or productivity or Windows or anything like that. So you do sacrifice on the display quality some. Also, the stand is not great. This is apparently fairly common among the Samsung D5 series of monitors or something. That stand is, it's fine. It doesn't have height adjustment. It doesn't have swivel. It has angle adjustment, but very minimal, right? You can tilt it back some. You can tilt it forward some. But otherwise, you need to make sure that your chair is adjustable to make sure because you want to be centered on this monitor because, like I said, it's not an IPS panel, so you want to make sure you're looking at it at the right angle that you should.
Is there a VESA mount on the back of it that you could hang it off of a monitor stand, or is it you basically use their stand or nothing?
Yep, no VESA mount. Also a feature of the Samsung D5 series of monitors, I guess. I say that because we actually bought a 27-inch 1080p panel that was like the U27D490P or something like that. And it has the exact same stand on it and no VESA mount, which is, again, disappointing. I think very few people actually take advantage of the VESA mounts on monitors, but it's nice to have that option, especially if the stand is really stinky, as this one quite obviously is. cool features. It has picture-in-picture and picture-by-picture. With the picture-in-picture, you can have an unscaled 1080p input. Right, which is because you with a 4K monitor, you have essentially four 1080p quadrants, and you can, you know, utilize a quadrant of that for 1080p. You can make it smaller if you want, and you can move it around the panel from, you know, top left, top right, bottom left, bottom right. And it's interesting if you have a TV input, you know, you can input through HDMI, or you have a separate computer, or you have some other kind of media device. You can, you know, implement that on the display if you want. You can do picture-by-picture, which will let you do 1920 by 2160 on each side, kind of like an MST monitor would do, not on purpose sometimes, but this time it's on purpose. And you can have different computers on either side of the device. So it's interesting feature-wise. I think from a performance standpoint, it's pretty good. You know, it's not a perfect panel, but. Mm-hmm. I think the upcoming Asus, Lenovo, Dell units, I think they're all based on the same panel. So I don't imagine there's going to be any dramatic difference between these. It's really going to come down to pricing, stand, VESA compatibility if you want something like that. And if you can find this last night at $599, that's an awesome, awesome deal, right? It's still a pretty good deal at like $680, in my opinion. But knowing that it sold for $599 yesterday makes paying $680 today a little bit
painful.
Yeah. And knowing that I paid $744 to get this review unit in also makes it a little bit more so, but there are no price guarantees.
And hey, it is technically an investment and a tax write-off for the organization there. Tax write-off humor aside, how did you feel about the 4K resolution on a monitor that small?
I don't think it was much different than on the 32-inch monitor, to be honest. Okay. It's obviously a little bit smaller, and so when you're talking about a 4K resolution, you've got very, very tiny pixels, which is good most of the time, especially for games. But when you're using it in a desktop environment with a 32 or with a 28-inch panel, if you don't turn on window scaling, it's going to be hard to read, I think, for most people, right? Even you're looking at a browser window at a 4K resolution at the standard viewing distance of these monitors is pretty tough. And so I would enable 125 or 150% scaling in Windows with Windows 8.1 and kind of improve some of that. And then that automatically sets your browsers and other applications that are you know, context aware for that, and it looks much better. Now you lose all the real estate idea, but you get a much sharper, clearer image. Right. So I see the benefits of both. And it depends on how good your eyes are and how much strain there is in focusing on small text.
Right.
So I
found it frustrating to go to like 150% scaling, because then I went from being able to fit four huge windows side by side to having one giant window. And it's funny because like I was pulling up, the thing that seemed really interesting to me was pulling up like huge images, like 12,000 by 12,000 pixels. These massive, massive images, and it's gorgeous to play around with them on a desktop that big. But your tool palette is you're sitting there like, where's my magnifying glass for my tool palette so I can find, you know, the lasso? And all of a sudden I thought, wow, now I'm going to want, you know, a 4K panel for the main thing I'm working on, and then a secondary panel that's 1080p so I can put all my palettes over there. And I'm like, just like 1998.
I did see if you go to tigerdirect.com, they actually have the monitor in stock for $599.
Nice.
As of us recording this. So if you're watching it live, maybe you want to go pick one of those up. If you're watching it after the fact, it may be sold out. Limit three per customer. So you're only allowed to get three 4K panels at a time.
I'm sorry. Right, I'm envisioning the GPU requirements to do triple head gaming with three 4K monitors.
That's actually an important thing to consider even for a single one, right? Is right. You got to make sure you have the GPU horsepower for it. The benefit that you get with this panel that you didn't get with the MST monitors is that you can run this at 1920 by 1080 or 25 by 14, and it scales, and it looks pretty good. And you can do that, right? You can play Crysis 3 at 1920 by 1080 on your 4K monitor if you have to, if you don't have the GPU horsepower to really push it. But you still have the upgrade path for 4K panel, and you still have the capability to use the 4K for, you know, productivity uses. With the Asus, the MST monitor, the Asus and the Sharp, you couldn't really run it at 1920 by 1080 reliably because of the multi-stream merging of things. It was very odd. So it very much just acts like a monitor now, right? Mm-hmm. A very high resolution monitor, whereas before it was a technology. It was something you had to configure and work with and make sure it was functioning. And now it's as it should have been, which is you just plug it in and it works. Right.
And I will say, if you can sport a pair of GTX 790 Ti's or Radeon R9 290Xs, your gaming results will be much better if you have a single 780 Ti or Radeon 290 or 295. It's man, it's amazing how much horsepower gaming requires when you quadruple the number of pixels. I have to give Mr. Ryan Trout even more credit than I usually give him, and I usually give him a lot of credit. He has managed to express the essence of what, 300 different Asus Z97 motherboards?
Seems like 300. It's probably close to 30, but it seems like 300.
So the Z97A, Z97 Deluxe, the Republic of Gamers, the Tough Series, Sabertooth, and the Z97 workstation boards. This is a lot of motherboards.
This is a lot of motherboards. I guess it was last Thursday. JJ came by the office, JJ from Asus, and he brought a bunch of stuff with him and did a bunch of demos. And we literally streamed for 5 hours and 9 minutes about motherboards. And you were hurt. So mentally it was a draining activity. and lots of great info there. But now what we have done is we've made that content available on YouTube in a staggered fashion. Right. So mainstream motherboard overview, which covers all of your Z97 dash whatever products, ABC, Lux, Pro, whatever, SLI, those types of things. And then you can get into another video that looks at the feature demonstrations of those boards, auto tuning, fan expert, five-way optimization, going into the BIOS or UEFI. We've got another video that looks at the ROG line, right? So the Republic of Gamers lineup, the which one do we have? The Hero and the Gene boards. And then the Tough series, which is the Workstation and the Griffins, one with those weird thermal armor add-ons to it. And the Workstation board that supports quad SLI, quad crossfire. It has all the SLI or PCI Express bridges as well. So lots of, 4.5 hours of video content for you to consume. I would recommend out over a couple of days, perhaps. Take a break.
Did any of them seem like there were going to be particular standouts in terms of, you know, performance or feature set versus affordability? Because it seems like to a certain degree, they're all going to have roughly the same performance unless we're talking about serious overclocking craziness.
Performance is going to be the same on all of these, to be completely honest. And actually, JJ was pretty upfront about like the overclocking capability, with very, very, very minor exceptions, is going to be uniform across their cheapest Z97 motherboard to their most expensive Z97 motherboard. The overclocking capability is not going to differ as you move up or down the product stack. What does change is the feature sets. So like the Republic of Gamers motherboards have a really interesting feature that they call the Keybot, which is a IC that is on the back of the motherboard that intercepts communications from a single USB port, and it allows them to do things like when the system is powered off, you can hit the delete key and it starts the machine and goes into the UEFI BIOS, right?
Oh, wow.
Automatically. And there's all kinds of, like, they're basically, they're intercepting all the keyboard input on that, on one of the USB ports, and then, filter it, whatever they, do what they're going to do, and then pass it on, right? And so you can do things like have hard-barred keyboard shortcuts that change BIOS settings while you're in Windows, directly, because that IC is communicating with the keyboard, not going through software or anything like that. So those types of features are what differentiates their different products. I would say, there's one of the five videos that we posted that you should look at. It would be either the first one or the second one, either the motherboard overview, the mainstream motherboard overview, because it's going to talk about kind of the feature set and characteristics that are universal across all of the cards or all of the motherboards, or the second one that actually goes into the software features of it, because so much of how motherboards differentiate themselves now is really on the software side, because hardware has become somewhat homogenous, as chipsets and processors have evolved.
Exciting stuff.
There's a lot there.
It's I don't know. I'm almost thinking about replacing, my 920. I'm almost there.
One day.
Well, you know what I mean? I don't know. I'll have to sit down and start running benchmarks again. That'll be horrifying and scary. Extended thoughts on AMD's Core Tech Update presentation. Final thoughts or extended thoughts? Final thoughts on AMD's Core Technology Update presentation. Josh wrote this up at PCPer.com. he was surprised, actually. I think everybody was just surprised by what came out of the announcement. And is his excitement abated as Josh decided that he was too excited too early?
No, I think really from his point of view, he just hadn't had the time to kind of sit down and compile the thoughts in there, because they had talked about so many interesting things, right? So they kind of broke, I don't know if they did, but Josh broke it down by year, which I think is interesting. So here's what to expect for the rest of 2014, 2015, 2016. 2014, the big focus was on, they talked about some of the existing stuff that's out there, Bima and Mullins, Kabini, Tamash. But they really talked about the availability of Seattle samples. And Seattle is the code name for AMD's first ARM-based processor. It says here it's 8 ARM Cortex A57 cores that run of about 2 gigahertz. It's going to be called the Opteron A1100. Includes DDR3 and DDR4 memory controllers, 8 lanes of PCI Express 3.0, 8 SATA 6G ports, and most interestingly, 2 10 gig Ethernet connections, which is pretty nice. It's only sampling now, available late 2014, early 2015 type products. So this is like the beginning of maybe the second step in AMD becoming, as they call, ambidextrous, right? So they're going to have six play and they're going to have an ARM play. Right. And that's something that I don't feel like Intel, on one hand, I kind of feel like Intel may do this sooner rather than later. On the other hand, I think they may still hold out longer on the x86 only style of play. And there's a whole lot of companies that are obviously sticking with the ARM only style of play. Pretty much everybody that's not Intel or AMD. 2015, talk about more of the transition into the APU world. They're also talking about an update to an ARM processor where they're basically taking the A57 core and tweaking it. As he says, going over the Cortex A57 with a fine-tooth comb and implementing as many power-saving tricks as possible, right? So Seattle will be kind of like the first step at that. 2015, I don't think we had a name associated with it, but basically a revamp of that architecture. And then maybe more interestingly is in 2016 where they announced that they're going to have instead of just taking an ARM core off the shelf and putting it into a processor, they're going to design their own core, similar to what NVIDIA is doing with its Project Denver, similar to what Qualcomm does with the Snapdragon line. This is much more unique, right? Very, very few people take this route to the ARM architecture. As Josh has here, Qualcomm, NVIDIA, and Samsung are really the only handful of people that do that. Most everybody else is taking what ARM has. Maybe they're making some small modifications to it, but it's a lot more work, but you can do a lot more with it, which is why Qualcomm has had so much success with their SoCs over the last, 5-10 years, is because they have done their own architectures and designs going in. So AMD, the idea of having a processor socket that you can put an x86 part or an ARM part in is like mind-blowing to me. That would be pin compatible processors, but that's the route they're going now. Like they're doing it. I don't know. They also announced a new x86 architecture, but with very, very few details about that. I think that was going to be a 2016 part as well. Not bulldozer based, excavator based, anything like that. Like completely new architecture from the ground up. We don't really know what product segments. We're looking at flagship, mainstream. For those particular APUs, but I'm hoping we'll see some higher end parts from them in that range. Maybe some architecture that will have that capability to scale to higher end into lower power. What we have with Intel's Haswell lines and their upcoming products too. So, a very interesting kind of announcement. I guess it was actually last week from AMD. Laying out their roadmap and being very open and honest about it. We'll see how that plays out.
Well, all they have to do is execute on it, deliver on time, and then the market has to buy it. Other than that.
Yeah, sounds simple.
It's easy. Speaking of simple, FreeSync has arrived on DisplayPort 1.2a. Jeremy writes on PC Per, AMD might have originally thought that dynamic refresh rates were not worth adding to their machines, but they did develop FreeSync quite a while ago. And now that G-Sync is available, they've changed their minds. Even better for the consumers, the way that they went about releasing it, not as proprietary hardware, which is only compatible with certain monitors, but as an update to the DisplayPort standard, which does not require any extra hardware. Of course, we'll have a while to wait before these monitors hit the shelves. The display scaler and control chip manufacturers will have to incorporate the new standard into their designs. But once they do, they should be functional on both NVIDIA and AMD as long as you are connecting with DisplayPort. Tech Report has a write-up on it. VESA, if you want to read a particularly dry press release, you are more than welcome to. What's kind of interesting is, we were talking around the DirectX 12 announcement. It's like, what's going to happen to G-Sync? What's going to happen with some of the other movements? And apparently some of them are going to be open sourced. Can you really call it open source if you turn it over to VESA?
it's less proprietary, and it's an open. I mean, Vista is not an open source thing, and it's not really an open standard, but it is a standard, right? It's an industry standard that has, you know, everybody is a part of it. NVIDIA, AMD, Intel, all those guys, they're all parts of that standards board. So, in that regard, it's definitely the better option in terms of interoperability going forward.
This is a good thing. Is this going to cause trouble for G-Sync, or is this going to create just another classic competing standards problem?
I think it does present a problem for G-Sync because we saw G-Sync in October for the first time. We saw it again, a lot of it, in January at CES. And then we kind of haven't heard anything from it at all since then, right? We still don't have any new G-Sync monitors out. Since the initial one, you know, like in the November, December timeframe of last year, and now it's mid-May. So if there are any more delays in these kind of buildups, that's going to cause more problems. Now, to be clear, like the DisplayPort 1.2a, we're probably talking at the very end of 2014 before you see the first displays that actually implement a scaler that's DP 1.2a compliant. Right. So they still have more time. NVIDIA still has more time. But every day they wait, every day that their partners wait from actually putting out devices is another day where doubts are raised. Consumers are going to wonder if it's maybe better to just wait for this DisplayPort 1.2a standard that should be the same. We still have questions. You know, I still have questions about, you know, what did they actually implement and how is it implemented? Is G-Sync still going to be a better option, perhaps? Is it going to, you know, without actually, I've seen what G-Sync does. I have not seen what Adaptive Sync, as they call it, actually does. And until they do, it's tough for anybody to really kind of like who on what NVIDIA has done, because we've seen it. You can't buy it, but we've seen it. So I don't know. I think at Computex, maybe we'll see a couple of demos of Adaptive Sync. That wouldn't surprise me if AMD is, you know, pushing hard to get some prototypes in place for that so they can actually show it to the media and kind of, you know, their goal is to slow the adoption of G-Sync while we to come into fruition, right? Because if people buy into G-Sync, they're buying into the NVIDIA ecosystem, they're going to be stuck there. That's what AMD's mindset is.
Well, how often do people really upgrade their monitors?
That's true. I mean, but if you hit them in that cycle, they're going to be stuck there for a long time. So,
oh my goodness. Yeah, I don't know. It's frustrating. I always get frustrated with competing standards, and will apparently continue to get frustrated for the probably rest of my time covering technology.
Yeah.
NVIDIA Titan Z missed its release date. Does anybody care? Outside of NVIDIA?
One second, Patrick. Hang on.
Emergencies all around.
Oh, my goodness. It's an exciting day. There he is.
So you can just start with that new question.
In 3, 2. NVIDIA Titan Z misses its release date. Scott wrote this up for PC Per. Does anyone care? I mean, you know, GTC Summit, they announced GTX Titan Z add-in board. 2 fully unlocked GK110 GPUs, each having access to 6 gigabytes of GDDR5 memory, 12 gigs in total. One board to rule them all and in the darkness bind them. Expected to show on May 8th. No sign of the boards in the marketplace, no comment from NVIDIA. And then we get what we think are leaked benchmarks. So
that's kind of a normal occurrence for us, right?
Yeah.
What? Leak benchmarks?
I believe that the release of AMD's 295X2 card probably had something to do with the delay on this. You know, they're not really targeting the same market, right? When Titan Z is a $3,000 product, the NVIDIA CEO got up on stage and talked about it and held one up and talked to everybody. And they were very upfront about it being more aimed at not professional users, but like scientific users, but like I don't want to say like low budget scientific users, but you know, people who are at universities, they can maybe afford $3,000, $6,000, or $9,000 for a set of these, but can't afford $40,000 or $50,000 for a couple of racks full of servers of GPUs for computing. Maybe this is how you start development in some of those software applications, right? That's really where they're trying to make their money on these parts, because they are the full double precision performance, you know, parts of these SKUs, right? So what I'm hoping, I'd have no idea if this is the case, I'm hoping is they cut the price in half, release a version of this that is single precision performance only, right? And you know, more in line with what a gamer would want in terms of pricing and performance. You know, otherwise, if they release this out and try to target it at gamers, I think it's going to, you know, not look favorable because of the release of the 295X2 card, which I think turned out better than most people had expected, NVIDIA included.
NVIDIA loves it when that happens. And actually, the entire gaming market enjoys it when that happens. Speaking of things the gaming market enjoys, AMD's Radeon R9 prices have leveled out. R9 280 drops to $249. The gold rush of Bitcoin GPU mayhem is pretty much done. So, you know, the R295X2 is still ridiculously expensive because it's an incredible board or a completely unhinged board. But the R9290X, $549 on Amazon.com, $529 at Newegg, the 290 down to $379. And the R9280X is as little as like $289 on Amazon.com. So, and there we go. The step of the Radeon R9 280 has dropped from $279 to $249. So yep. I like less expensive GPUs because I am cheap.
Yeah, it's just good to see them back at the prices they were supposed to be. It's a little disappointing that it's taken so long. We first heard about the 290 and 290X in October. Right. And they've probably been close to their suggested pricing for about a maybe close to a month. But it definitely, you know, for a long time we were recommending NVIDIA cards, not necessarily because of performance or features, but because, hey, the other ones are just way overpriced. So this was your option. So now it kind of brings everything and the competition that we're supposed to see back into the fold. And I'll be curious to see if these price drops or these price adjustments, leveling out, as I called it, we'll start to see improvements in AMD's kind of GPU market share. The last two quarters, AMD actually lost market share to NVIDIA on the graphics side on GeForce versus Radeon. So I'm curious if a lot of that was because of the super high prices by coin mining affecting, you know, the gaming community, and if that will be reversed or change direction now that things are at a sane price point.
I've always loved a good sane price point. Was the crowbar a hint of what was to come in the wall behind you, or was the crowbar actually a Half-Life 2 portal coming to Shield? A gimme toy?
It was potential. Definitely. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on this. So you probably don't have a Shield. But
I
you
do,
have,
in fact, have access to a Shield at work.
Okay. The idea
I've used
of
it.
This on it, what do you think? Because I have not played either Portal or Half-Life 2 on the Shield yet, but Ken has. He actually finished all the way through Portal on the Shield and started playing a couple hours of Half-Life 2, he said. So it's actually a pretty good experience. You know, all things considered, I think maybe the price is still too high, right? It's $10 for each of these titles, and they're fairly old games. But it's interesting to see them take that approach of, we're going to make this a premier gaming platform, and here's how we're going to do it, by doing pretty much all of the legwork to get these games on this platform.
I just am not holding my breath on that happening.
$199 and, you know, the value of it is still up in the air. Like, you've got the game stream capability. You've got, you know, it's just kind of a tablet, you know, an Android environment.
Have you ever game streamed? Look me in the eye and tell me if you've ever game streamed outside of product testing.
Okay, no. That little clarification that totally changed it all. So I'm not looking anymore. I answered the question.
Don't get me wrong. For the dedicated, you know, if you are dedicated to gaming and you cannot pause the game to go to the toilet, I completely see why you might. I don't know. It's a curious product. It's certainly it's a well built product. It feels nice in the hand. The performance is good. I just think there's just too many things you can do with an actual standard tablet. But you know, I'm going to take a moment to thank our sponsor, iFixit. iFixit.com is a free online repair manual for everything, people. More than 10,000 repair guides for everything from electronics like your smartphone, your tablet, your game console, your home appliances, clothing, even your bike. They also have foolproof instructions to fix all your stuff. You shattered your iPhone screen, and kids, I have. Look at that. As a matter of fact, they've got some pretty good instructions for the iPhone 5C, for the iPhone 5S. They will tell you how to replace every single component inside of your damaged and abused iPhone, Android devices, your Mac computers. It's good stuff. And there's a couple of iFixit tools we want to introduce to you today. The ProTek screwdriver set and the magnetic project mat. I'm a longtime user of the ProTek screwdriver set. One screwdriver set, people, to rule them all. 15 screwdrivers specifically chosen by the iFixit Teardown team. These drivers can handle more than 90% of electronics repairs because they have a whole bunch of bits in the box. They're actually very well made. We've been using one set of them, I want to say, 2 or 3 years here. Black oxide grip for increased grip durability and corrosion resistance. Fixed blade swivel top design for added precision. That's like the jeweler's kind where you have a little swivel on the top. Custom tool roll makes this a handy portable toolkit for amateurs and professional fixtures alike. Lifetime warranty, $59.95, which is not bad given what I've paid for some Weehaw screwdrivers over the years. As a matter of fact, given what I've paid for some screwdrivers that fell apart over the years, this is a fantastic deal. I also got to say, I fell in love with the magnetic project mat recently. I got conned into repairing a drone here at work. Somebody managed to blow all four engines on their drone, and I ended up pulling, I think, 7 screwdrivers on each of the four corners of that drone. And it's a mat. You can write on it. And it's magnetic. So I had all of the screws laid out as I pulled the project. As somebody who's used hundreds of yards of blue tape to hold down screws and other small parts during project build, this is great. It's an original iFixit invention. And I love the fact that it's got a dry erase surface that you can take notes. So I was basically able to, you know, well, there you go. You basically have a pad. It's divided into squares. You can lay the parts out. You can draw. You can label things. It is really cool. And I got to say, you need never lose another screw again. $19.95. This is the kind of tool that will pretty much last forever unless the dog gets a hold of it, or dogs, in the case of Ryan Trout. Yeah. So with iFixit, people, you can fix it yourself. Visit iFixit.com/twit for more than 10,000 free step-by-step guides. iFixit also sells every part and tool you'll need. Enter the code TWITCH at checkout. You'll save $10 off any purchase of $50 or more. That is iFixit.com/twit. Enter TWITCH at checkout. And we want to thank iFixit for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Good stuff, people. We like things we can fix because that's just how we are. Oh, my goodness. I started to ask you about this before the show, and I thought maybe it might be fun to ask it on the show. What are the least expensive AMD APUs you would use to build a home theater PC with and without gaming, Ryan?
Because if you're confident in the fact that you won't do any kind of even modest gaming potential in it, I think the new the AMD AM1 platform is a pretty compelling option for that. I want to say that's the Athlon 5530. Now that I'm drawing a blank, the Athlon 5350 is a Kabini-based 50 hertz 25 watt processor. It is an APU, so it does have integrated graphics. Obviously, it's a $60 processor. Like I said, 25 watts. So you could, I mean, I think the board for this is going to be $30 as well, and one stick of memory. You know, if you're doing a lot of transcoding on the fly, this maybe would not be a great option because it is, you know, I mean, it's a quad core part, but it's a low end processor, to be honest. But for running Windows, running video playback, decoding, it will be able to do all those things flawlessly. You know, maybe not 4K video, not H.265, some of those new higher end things. But in terms of getting a home theater PC up and running, this part, you know, we don't have to worry about cooling considerations. You could probably run this passive if you really want to, if you were looking for that silent environment or silent situation.
Silent but functional. Not to be confused with silent but dead.
Yeah, the AM1 Mini ITX motherboard is $35.99. Right, so you get both of those under $100. You add a stick of memory and whatever your storage is and your case and power supply, and that's it, and you're good to go.
Wow, that's tempting.
It's pretty awesome, right? And the motherboards are completely passive, right? There's no, you don't have to worry about it. Like it's an all in an SoC, so there's no even really main chipset on the motherboard. It's just you've got your SATA ports, you've got your mSATA, you've got your PCI Express DIMM slots. And then you've got all your connections, DVI, VGA, if you need it, PS2, those types of things to keep your machine running. Now, if you are gaming, if you're doing some kind of modest gaming, I think you go for the highest end, the A10, the 800, I think is what it is. That's model numbers are just totally screwing me up today. 76...
Oops, sorry.
So it's whatever the highest end, most current Trinity-based part is. And that's, again, you're probably looking at 384 stream processors, modest gaming, 1080p, 720p at low to mid image quality settings. You'll be totally fine doing those, but not much above that, right? If you really want to game, then you need to get a discrete card. Even if you're doing like 1080p at good quality image settings, you know, getting something like a R7 265 or a GTX 750 Ti. Right. It's really what you want to do there. Obviously adding to the cost, adding to power, adding to size. Wow. Everything that
you can always do it one step at a time. I have an idea around that AM1 platform though. Passive cooling is in my future. Twitch at twit.tv is the email address if you want to get a hold of Mr. Ryan Shrout or Mr. Patrick Norton. You can also, because we are so incredibly creative and rooted in the anonymity, I feel like Nemo from Finding Nemo, anonymity of the internet, at Ryan Shrout or at Patrick Norton on Twitter. Thank you for not completely bursting into hysterical laughter. Someday the braces will come off. Daniel writes in, hi guys. Love the show, longtime listener. I've recently been building several AM1 systems, one for myself for the bedroom from watching video in bed primarily, replacing an old laptop connected to my older 1610 monitor, and a few others for friends and mostly family. Finally ready to replace their aging Pentium 4 systems, and in one case, a Pentium 3. $350 all in seems to be the price tag that finally gets people to say, it's time, put her down. And there's just nothing sadder than putting down a Pentium 3 that's been running for the better part of a decade, except maybe putting down your dog. Well, probably definitely putting down your dog. In any case, I love the level of coverage you guys have been doing with AM1, answering a lot of questions about usages that would never show up in the real world. You do it best so we don't have to. And I'm going to relay that all on Ryan because, dude, your coverage on that has been huge. I'm very impressed with the performance of these systems. Continues Daniel, especially my own with the 5350 ASRock AM1BM, a cheap SanDisk 64GB SSD for pretty much operating system only and every other part hand-me-downs from older systems. Makes a great flash gaming, surfing, and video watching rig with a wired connection to my main rig with the 6 terabytes of drives. As I tinker with these cheap little toys, I wonder, and after all that blah, 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 here is finally my question. Would it be possible for AMD or a third-party vendor to create custom chipsets for these sweet little processors, something like an onboard SATA data controller for adding more drive capability, or a PCI controller to add more slots, Wi-Fi, serial ports, RAID chips, IDE ports, et cetera, et cetera? Or does the system on a chip nature of Kabini make this impossible, conflict prone, or just way too pricey to even consider? Thanks for reading my pondering and keep up the great show. Fun and informative with regular appearances of puppies and kittens. What's not to love?
Indeed.
Daniel, that's a really nice letter. Man, this also reminds me of some of the things I've heard about Raspberry Pi. Yeah. Why doesn't have this on the motherboard? Why doesn't have that on the motherboard? Could we put the other thing on the motherboard? And I think partially is what makes these boards work is keeping them as simple as possible, and they kind of have a mainstream idea of what the user base for this board is going to be, and they kind of concentrate on that. I mean, I have the same issue. Like, Intel's NUCs are really cool. They're self-contained. They've got decent processors. Would it hurt them to put another Ethernet jack on there, or a bunch of a Thunderbolt port so I could connect it to an exterior RAID? Because there's all these cool things I could do around networking builds or server type builds, but there's inherent limitations in the hardware, because essentially these are super simple boxes or super simple processors designed for basic computing details like you're running into. Is there anything that actually in Kabini that would completely prevent them from adding in additional features?
No, it really is a cost issue.
Right.
Anytime you add a chip to a board, you add complexity, you add the cost of the chip, you add the complexity of design. A lot of these motherboards on this platform are 2- and 4-layer PCBs, which is really low. That's how you can get a $35 motherboard, right? There's not much to it. Anytime you add a storage controller or if you add, I think maybe you probably find some with Wi-Fi on there, but adding storage directly on the motherboard itself. Anytime you add something to it, you're adding complexity and you're adding price to it. And the number of people that are willing to buy a $35 motherboard for that platform versus people who are willing to buy a $100 motherboard for that platform are quite different. And AMD is, these companies have been doing this a long time, AMD and their motherboard partners, they know a certain dollar amount is all people are going to pay for a certain platform, right? So they know how many $400 motherboards are going to make. They know how many $200 motherboards are going to make. And they know how many $30 motherboards are going to make, because they know how many they're going to sell unless something really weird happens. There's no technical reason, though, except for maybe a lack of PCI Express slots that would maybe limit how many different controllers you could put on it. But I don't think the boards that exist now really hit that limit, so...
It would be nice. And what's kind of the really crazy promise of 3D printing and nano, I'm the guy who's always trying to make stuff work. So I look at something and all I can see is like, well, that's going to fail, or this is going to explode, or this is going to eat your face, or that's going to be too expensive. But, there's this possibility as we start looking at 3D printing and some of the possibilities of, whether it's nanotechnology or self-replicating designs or just all of this unbelievably unprecedented ability to do small-scale manufacturing, there might be a day where you could, go onto a website, do a checklist of features that you want, and, 72 hours later, 48 hours later, 120 hours later, however long it takes for the machine to yark out your motherboard, you would get a custom motherboard with all the individual features you wanted. Certainly on some level, a lot of the motherboard manufacturers would love to be able to fill their demand and not carry any inventory. But that would also afford the opportunity for you to be like, hey, I want this super simple low power processor, but I need a few more SATA ports, or I'd like a second Ethernet jack, or I'd like a side of chips, or whatever you particularly want on that. And that's something I hope we see in the coming years as they sort of perfect this incredible sort of just-in-time manufacturing. Well, it's not really just-in-time, but I think y'all get what I'm trying to say. I dream, people. I dream. One last one before we go. An email from Keith says, a couple of episodes ago, Patrick mentioned his 6-drive free NAS box. He has mentioned his build several times between Twitch, Texilla, HD Nation, and DIY Tryon. Patrick, could you please send or post your build? If the hardware in your build has been discontinued, they do that sometimes. Could you post the what available hardware would be the equivalent to what you used? Thanks so much. Love the show and keep up the good work. I will point you to our second FreeNAS build on Dytrion, where we had some of the developers, one of the lead developers, one of the co-founders, essentially, of FreeBSD, and he's kind of the CTO. I hope I got that right, at IX Technology, who is the company that is sort of stewarding the FreeNAS system. There's some really interesting debates in the forums when you look at FreeNAS, and some of them come down to, you know, do you need ECC memory? And the answer is, if you're serious about data protection, you do. And the fact that as fun as it is to do like a NAS for free build, which is a variation on FreeNAS with very, very inexpensive or junk hardware, you know, that will mean you're protecting your data with junk hardware. And if you're trying to do some of the more sophisticated, you know, and when I say sophisticated, I want to translate that as cool, awesome, and really core to FreeNAS, parity data protection, some of the more advanced file systems, you need a lot of horsepower to throw at that. And oh, wow, FreeNAS 9.2.1.5, waking up edition, Thursday the 24th. You step away from the FreeNAS website for a couple of weeks and suddenly there's a new development. You know, but if you want to do the ZFS file system, you know, you need a badass processor. So essentially what I have to boil it down to the simplest collection is I have a motherboard I bought locally because it was the only motherboard I could find in the area compatible with a mid-range Core i5 processor socket from 3 years ago. Because just as I started the FreeNAS build, my my motherboard, the magic smoke came out of my motherboard, and I had to buy a motherboard in the Bay Area with about 2 hours to spare, which basically left me with one motherboard option within a 30-minute drive. You know, I would say a motherboard with integrated graphics, you know, if you want to do serious data protection, you're probably looking at an ECC build. If you are too worried about sort of random acts of the gods breaking your bits, then I would go with something around a Core i5, a gigabyte of RAM per terabyte of storage, and the best hard drives you can afford. You know, Reds would be really good in this situation. But take a look at the conversation we had during that FreeNAS episode of Dytrion, and you will get a ton of information. I also cannot emphasize enough going to freenas.org and take a look at the community support team, the documentation. There is an unbelievable amount of information in there, including some ideas, lots of ideas, actually, on how you should do a build. And I would take their advice over mine in this case, because they will tell you the absolute best way to do it, and then you can kind of deviate from there if you choose to. But yeah, mostly it was like, hey, I got a Core i5 processor. I got to get a motherboard that works since this one just yarked. And oh, wow, I need an inexpensive GPU since this mother, the only motherboard I could buy that would work with my processor, didn't have integrated graphics. And I got 8 gigabytes of RAM from another machine. So it was not a sophisticated parts build, but it works really well. So one last thing before we go, sparkfun.com/product/retired/2A7. That is the portable rotary phone. So the people at SparkFun, I don't know if Burke, you found that link down there at the bottom, but the people from SparkFun did this insane build a long time ago. They sell components and they teach you how to do things like surface mount soldering and stuff. But they were selling a kit or a pre-done or information on how they built it, which essentially was a rotary phone that had been modified to work over cell phone systems. one of the single coolest things I've ever seen in my life. Sadly, it is no longer offered for sale. So that would be the ultimate retro phone. But yeah, I actually think you know, and Ryan, oh, lost Ryan's audio.
Are we there?
There he is.
All right. I would carry that with me.
I want one like on the I want one on the sort of dashboard of my truck.
It's pretty good too, honestly.
It would be or you know what I really want is one of the sort of, you know, remember the phones that used to hang on the wall in mom's kitchen with the big steel hanger on it? That would be so awesome in the truck. In any case, we want to thank each and every one of you for listening or viewing the podcast. The name of the podcast is Twitch, T-W-I-C-H. That's twit.tv/Twitch or Twitch at twit.tv if you want to email us. Ryan, is there anything you can reveal that's coming up at PC Per, or are you sworn to silence by NDA?
No, let's see what we're doing. We're going to do some actual benchmarking with the SST monitor versus MST monitors. There is rumbling. Might be some performance differences on multi-GPU systems. I don't understand why yet, but that's the rumor. And then we have at least two more Z97 motherboard reviews coming out this week as well. MSI and probably an EVG. So motherboards.
Cool. Dytrine this week. We just finished with much pain and suffering. We built a wireless key charger for Android phones. Michael has a Nexus 4 into a wooden phone stand. So you basically pop your phone down in this very nice oak stand that'll instantly start charging. Wireless charging, I'm just going to say it's a pain. That's all I'm going to say. I charge my phones by cable now.
Wireless Ethernet versus wired Ethernet, wireless charging versus wired charging. Same thing.
Oh, my goodness. It's so close and yet so far. And that is kind of the nature of hardware on a bad day. That's it for this episode of Twitch. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schrout.
We'll see you next week.